Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right, good afternoon, folks. Welcome back once again to another edition of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. And in fact, it is the Tanakh edition, the part where we talk about some of the other parts of Scripture that don't get as much play. As you know, in the so-called New Testament churches, they do ignore anything that precedes Matthew chapter 1. And I think for the most part, they don't even like anything before John. On the other hand, on the Torah weekly services, we spend a lot of time talking about the first five books. But other than the Haftorahs, some of the rest of the Bible tends to get short shrift. So what we've been doing is going through a number of those, including the prophets, and most recently, the new book that we started here just a few weeks back is Ezekiel. And, of course, he had a whole lot to say, and a whole lot of that, as we're going to see when we go through here, really, really impacts us and should resonate today. But in any case, last time we ended around chapter 3, verse 010, give or take. And why don't I say first a howdy, since we didn't get together last week, to Ken. He can turn over to MP, and then I'll go ahead and read those next few verses. So how are you doing, Ken?
Well, I made it to my new home, my little cabin, today on time, and I just hope that the internet here will keep me connected. So let's all say a prayer for my connection. I mean, but anyway, hello all.
Yeah, Father, give them a divine connection.
That's right.
All right.
And shalom all.
Okay, very good. And MP, yeah. You got something you want to say besides howdy?
Just want to say howdy, and let's go ahead and read verses 10 through 14 or 15, something like that.
Okay, so
I'll go ahead and get started.
This is where Ezekiel is getting ready to eat this scroll. Actually, I think he has eaten it. And it says in verse 10, "Moreover, he," meaning Yah, "said to me, Son of man, receive into your heart all my words that I speak to you, and hear with your ears, and go get to the captives, to the children of your people, and speak to them, and tell them, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, whether they hear or whether they refuse. Then the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me a great thunderous voice, saying, Blessed is the glory of Yahuwah from this place. I also heard the noise of the wings of those living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels beside them, and a great thunderous noise. So the Ruach, the Spirit, lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of Yahuwah was strong upon me. And then he says, I came to the captives in Tel Aviv, who dwelt by the river Chebar, and I sat where they sat, and I remained there, astonished among them 7 days. So let's go to UMP and comment as you would on that.
All right, here we go. In verses 10 and 11, Yah wants Zeke to not only hear and understand what he is told to say, but to feel it in his heart and be emotionally attached to it. When in verse 11 he is told to go to Babylon, to the diaspora in bondage, and tell them that Yah was in store for Yehuda. So a Zamra on that. It says, following the vision of the chariot, in which Ezekiel opened, Ezekiel 1:1, and his appointment was as prophet in chapter 2, verse 1 through 3:10. God now tells him in verse 11 of our present chapter, chapter 3, to return to the main body of exiles in Babylon, from which he had become separated when he began to prophesy by the river Kivar. Okay, then, in verse 12, he was taken in the spirit, I assume, to Babylon. I assume in the time that it took for him to be transported in or by the spirit to Babylon. Not much time at all. Bing, bing, like that. The voice of the great rushing could very well have been the air blowing by his ears, as he was transported by the Ruach to Babylon. Or it could just be the presence of Yah's spirit. What was the noise angels, or the apostles rather, heard on Pentecost and Shavuot. In Acts chapter 2, it said, "And when the day of Pentecost, Shavuot, was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place, and suddenly there came the sound from heaven as of a mighty rushing wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting. And there appeared unto them cloven tongues like as of fire, and it sat upon each of them. And they were all filled with Ruach HaKodesh and began to speak with other tongues as the Ruach gave them utterance." Great rushing, mighty rushing wind. Does that seem the same to you? It seems that the noise of the rushing mighty wind of Ruach on Shavuot and the noise of the wings in Yechezkel's vision are just about identical. How about this from Revelation chapter 1 and verses 10 through 15? "I was in the Spirit on Yah's day, and heard behind me a great voice, as of a trumpet, saying, I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. And what thou seest, write in a book, and send unto the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, and unto Pergamos, and Thyatira, and Sardis, and to Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that spake with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks, and in the center of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the boot, his foot, rather, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hair like white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters." Here we go again, sound of many waters. Here's Azamra's commentary on verse 12. "In the words of Rashi, after he completed giving his instructions, he commanded the wind to carry him to the place where the exiles were. Metsudas David explains, "It is as if he was saying to the prophet, do you think that now that the Shekinah is leaving its place in the temple holy of holies, the glory of Hashem will not be blessed and praised as it was when it was in the place in the Holy of Holies? For even though it will have left its place, he is still blessed and praised." I.e., in other words, his true glory transcends any possible earthly revelation of it, since nobody can know his place. The phrase, "blessed be the holy from this place," or his place, is the second response to the Kedusha, the sanctification, recited by the prayer leader and congregation at the high point of the communal repetition of the daily morning and afternoon Amidah and Shabbos and festival Musaf prayers immediately following the joint response of "Holy, Holy, Holy," Isaiah 6:3. The verse here in Ezekiel 3:12 is also recited in Kedushah de Sidra, the place of the prayer Uva Letzion, after the daily morning Amidah and Mincha on Shabbos and festivals and on Saturday nights. That's the end of my quote from Azamra. Here's me again. The rushing mighty wind sure gets around, doesn't it? And the noises of wind blowing by your ear also sounds a lot like a waterfall or a set of rapids. There's another thing that would sound like a rushing mighty wind of many waters. And I think that's what Ezekiel describes in verse 13, the noise of great rushing wheels, which is how he describes the sound of the living creature's wings. The Hebrew word translated rushing here is the Hebrew 7494 from the Hebrew 7493, ra'ash, to undulate, to move violently, like an earthquake. The Zamra has this on verses 13 and 14, just one sentence. Ezekiel could still hear the awesome sound of the wings of the chayot and the noise of the ofanim as the spirit carried him away from the place of his vision back to the exiles in Babylon. So he's in Babylon, okay, but he was taken somewhere in vision and now he's gone back, okay. Now Yechezkel seems to be saying in verse 14, that he was personally miffed, that Yah physically took him away, and that he actually tried to fight Ruach. Zeke had absolutely no control over where he went physically because Yah had him, but he went in bitterness, which is from the Hebrew 48:43, marar, to arouse bitterness. So Yah purposely took Yehezkel to where Zeke wanted to be in his service to him, to where Yah knew was more important in his grand scheme of things. Yah is basically telling Zeke, aspet, that's Italian for pigeon Italian, actually, for wait a minute. This is more important right now. I'll take you back when you've accomplished what I need you to do now. And by the way, Yah can take him back to the exact time and place that he took him from, so no time will be lost to Zeke or his ministry to whomsoever he was ministering, and the person Zeke was ministering to will not even notice anything strange about it either, not even a flicker. Zeke is there, and he'll be right back if that's what Yah needs him to do. Ain't random access to time and space awesome? That would be Yah. Okay, that's what I got through verse 14.
Okay, how about you, Ken?
Well, let me see here. I know beginning in 10, Mark mentioned about receiving in thine heart, which really jumped out at me about this verse because, you know, again, it's good that Yah is making a point here that Ezekiel needs to put his words first in his heart because he's going to speak them. He's going to exude them. You know, they will come from Ezekiel. So he first needs to put it in his heart. That's what Yah has been teaching his people from the beginning. I'm going to give you my instruction. You're going to put it in your heart, and then you're going to do it. You know, you're going to say it to others. You're going to do it. But you first got to put it in your heart. And of course, he's going to say it here, too. I just think we need to catch that little tidbit because it's so important to all of us for everything we read in Scripture, that we've got to put it in our heart before we can really make sense of it and do it, you know? Anyway, so jumping to 11. Now, 11, I thought it was interesting how it ended when it, you know, you see these words, whether they will hear or whether they will not, you know, they will forbear. I can't help but recall our Messiah directing his disciples in Matityahu or Matthew chapter 10 to do the same thing as Ezekiel is being directed here. They were told to share the word, whether they accepted it or not. Now, remember, beginning in about in verse 5 of Matthew chapter 10, it says, these 12 Mashiach sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles and into any city of the Samaritans, enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Yisrael. Now, let me stop right there because, boy, I hope every time people see those words that not only is it applicable throughout all of Scripture, but we have to make note that our Messiah makes note of it more than once. Because remember, back in Matityahu or Matthew 15, verse 24, when he was responding to his disciples, he said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Yisrael. So let's not forget that. He was there specifically for this type of people, okay? A people that were his father's children, but they were lost. They needed Mashiach to help them come back. So, in jumping back to Matthew 10, it goes on to say, and as ye go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves, for the workman is worthy of his meat. And into whatever city or town ye shall enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and there abide till ye go thence. Now let me stop there too, because there you can see that there is judgment going on here. There's judgment required for his disciples to assess who are these people. You know, are these the lost sheep? You know, are they of Yah? Do they have Yah in their hearts? Okay, so that's really what that's pointing out right there. And moving on to verse 12, and when ye come into a house, salute it. And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it be not worthy, let your peace return to you. And whosoever shall not receive you, nor hear your words, when you depart out of the house or city, shake off the dust of your feet. Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Now, that was Mashiach telling his disciples where to go and what to do exactly. And this is their role as his disciples. I mean, even after he's gone, this is what they are to do. And thus, it really should be what we ought to do. You know, we ought to be doing the same thing to all those around us, you know, because we are in the world. We might not be of it, but we're in it, and we have to share his word, you know, the best we can. And this is exactly what Yah is telling Ezekiel in verse 11, that whether they hear or they don't hear, they refuse to hear, you know, you're still going to go there and tell them because you are that witness, you know. So I couldn't help but note that it does seem more clear that there is judgment going on in Mashiach's days, in that the disciples were to make decisions along the way. And in Ezekiel's day, it also gets specific in that he is to not only go to those who are captive, but to those who are his people, his father's people. It seems clear to me that Ezekiel has the spiritual wisdom to make such decisions as to whom is of Yah and who is not. And I'm sure that the spirit that has filled him is surely of such assistance, right? I mean, he's filled with the Spirit as well. So most surely he's going to be able to assess people. What was there a comment out there?
No, I'm just agreeing with you. That was it. That's exactly what's going on.
Right, okay. Now, verses 12 and 13, it's interesting to see that in the midst of this vision that the living creatures are distinctively being noted as being there with them. And we hear their wings, their wheels, their voices as a great rushing. And these sounds were pointed out in chapter 1 of Ezekiel, but most of chapter 1 was full of physical detail. Thus it appears that it's important to Yah that Ezekiel continues to hear these living creatures. And we'll have to note this as we continue reading through the scroll of Ezekiel. And I'm glad that Mark made a note there too of these connections. We always got to make those thematic connections of, you know, the rushing wind. It very well could be connected, right? Now, verse 14, I find it interesting, very interesting, that the first occurrences of two different words in this verse, both the English translation of bitterness, which is mar or mara in the Hebrew, Strong's number H4751, and heat, or chema, in the Hebrew, H2534, that the first instances of these two words reside with Esau back in Bereshit, or Genesis chapter 27, as we see in these two verses. Now, this is Bereshit 27, verses 34 and 44. I'm going to read these two. 34 says, and when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry. There's that word, bitter. Right. And said unto his father, yes, bless me, even me also, O my father. So you can see as at the first instance what this bitterness really can be or can feel like, right? Now, yeah. Verse 44 is the word fury instead of the word heat, but it's the same Hebrew word chema, where it says, and tarry with him a few days until thy brother's fury turn away. And again, that's speaking of Esau's fury because of what happened. So he was angered, and that is the heat that he feels within. Thus, bitterness is truly a feeling of great despair, and heat, being a feeling of great anger. And thus I think it's important that Yah notes that his hand is upon Ezekiel to guide him in such thoughts. So fury, for example, it could lead to quickened and possibly irrational responses that one might be sorry for pursuing afterwards. I think Job presents a more acceptable usage of such fury or wrath, where it's written in Job 19, verse 29. He says, "Be ye afraid of the sword, for wrath bringeth the punishments of the sword, that ye may know there is a judgment." We know Yah's wrath is always justified. And we should, of course, do the same, right? For us to do the same, we need to keep our wits about us and not get swept up in emotion. We should weigh our desired actions against his word to ensure that what we are about to do is in accordance with his ways. Now, this would be likened to his hand being upon Ezekiel, for his word would guide us as he would physically with his hand. That's where I'm making this connection here, you know. His hand is guiding Ezekiel just like his word guides us through our rough times, through our emotions, you know, through times of choice when we need to choose rightly, you know. And this happens to be one of those times. I could go on and, let me go ahead and comment on verse 15 before I turn this over, okay?
Sure.
Now, this is where he then came to Tel Aviv, which I remember that city quite well myself, by the river Kibar, and I sat where they sat and remained there, astonished among them 7 days. Now, I think it's no quinky-dinky, as one of my brothers would say, that Yah figuratively shuts up, it's the word, Hebrew word, sagar, shuts up Ezekiel amongst these at Tel Aviv for 7 days. It started, this idea of shutting up, it started back when Yah had Noah before the 40 days and nights of rain began in Bereishit chapter 7. Also, so recall Mitzrayim being, or which was the first plague in Shemot or Exodus chapter 7. Recall the Pesach, in which every house was to be shut up unto leavenlessness, if that's a word, for 7 days in Shemot or Exodus chapter 12, and Vayikra or Leviticus 23, and Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 28, and Devarim or Deuteronomy verse 16, or chapter 16. It's in all four of those locations. Recall that high priests were to be shut up within the tabernacle for 7 days for their consecration in Vayikra or Leviticus chapter 8. Recall the shutting up of those with the plague of leprosy for 7 days in Vayikra or Leviticus 13. Recall the shutting up of the house with leprosy in the next chapter of 14. And recall even Miriam being shut up from the camp for 7 days in Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 12. Recall those that toucheth a dead body and thus were found unclean were shut up from the camp for 7 days in Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 19. If we familiarize ourselves with these events, excuse me, mentioned in the Torah.
Sometimes I let
I'll finish up after.
We'll do that after.
God, I'm breathing, and I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something, either I'll turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we know what I'm fighting for.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that line bound by the law. The 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
All right, we are back, folks. The Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh Edition, and the Book of Ezekiel. When we went to the bottom of the hour break, we interrupted Ken. So let's go back to him, let him finish it up, and then we will read on.
Yeah, I think I had finished noting some verses where his people were shut up. And if we familiarize ourselves with these events mentioned in the Torah, one might note that they are all connected with judgment. It's my feeling that just like how we, as his people, are to be on this earth for 7 of his days, or 7 millennium, before eternity begins, Yah desires and thus utilizes this particular amount of time to help us get straight with him. I'm sure Ezekiel needed this time to both observe and make judgment upon these captives in Tel Aviv, and thus Yah kept him there for exactly 7 days, as is his will. So that's how I was making the 7-day connection. So that's what I had through verse 15. I'll go ahead and turn it over to you, MC.
Okay, are we ready then? We'll continue to read the
absolutely.
Not quite the whole chapter, but we'll get a lot of it here. Now, it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying, Son of man, I have made you a watchman. And this, of course, is one of a number of references to the watchman we're going to find in the book of Ezekiel, most famously in chapter 33. It'll take us a while to get there, but we're going to see this again. I made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, hear a word from my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, that same wicked shall die in his Torahlessness, his iniquity. But his blood I will require at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his Torahlessness, his iniquity. But you have delivered your soul. And let's go two more, because they're making they're finishing the point here. Again, when a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, Torahlessness, and when I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because you did not give him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he's done shall not be remembered. But his blood I will require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning. Also, you will have delivered your soul. So let's pause. MP, we'll go to you.
Wow. Wow, that's important stuff. So, Yah dropped him off, Zeke. He dropped Zeke off in Tel Aviv for a week of sitting astonished. The Hebrew translated astonished is shamam, but vowel pointed as a plural, shamim. The root means to desolate or lay waste, but it has a mem prefix which means from desolations. So, Yehezkel was as astonished, desolated, of Tel Aviv's condition after the Chaldeans left, as were the people who actually dwelt there, and were left to fend for themselves amidst the destruction, the devastation rather. Now, Azamra gives us some good info on this Tel Aviv. This is not the Tel Aviv in Israel. This is the Tel Aviv in Babylon. Okay? And here's what it says. Then I came to the exiles in Tel Aviv in verse 15. And here's what Azamra says. A tel is a hill or a mound, while Aviv refers to ripe barley, which in Israel is a sign of spring. It is indeed after the name of the Jewish place of exile in Babylon, which we're talking about now, mentioned in our present verse, that the modern Israeli city of Tel Aviv was named when it was founded in 1909 to serve as a residential suburb of the ancient port city of Jaffa. The name had been used by the author Nahum Sokolov as the title of a Hebrew translation of Theodor Herzl's Old New Land to symbolize the spring-like rebirth of a new state on the mound remaining from a much earlier state. Okay? So that's really cool, and I really like that thing. And it gives us an idea of what we're talking about here, because this Tel Aviv that we're talking about is not the Tel Aviv that you're thinking of out there in Radioland. This is a place all of its own, and it's a mound of spring. That's the idea. Then, in verses 15 and 16, Devar Yah came to Zeke. I think that Yah Yeshua empowered and filled Zeke for a full week. The prophet may not have slept that whole time, but I think came out from the empowering totally refreshed and ready to carry on as usual. Azamra has a salient comment on verses 16 and 17. They say, Ezekiel spent 7 days in a state of total shock following his return from the exalted world of prophetic vision to the bustling center of the Babylonian exiles from Yehuda, until God spoke to him again with further teaching about the nature of his mission in verses 15 and 16. The prophet was obliged to address both the wicked and the righteous. He was to warn the wicked to turn from their evil ways, and he was to warn the righteous not to allow themselves to lapse. If the prophet failed to rebuke them, he would bear responsibility for their evil deeds and lapses. But as long as he discharged his duty, he would be clean, and they alone would bear the consequences of their evil. That's the end of Azamra's note. Now, knowing the personification of Devar Yah to be Yeshua, I assume that that is who or what came to Zeke, the risen Yah Yeshua, complete with nail and crown and thorn scars. And he talked to Ezekiel, perhaps appearing also to the men of Tel Aviv and speaking directly to them. Now, I know that the word was directly spoken to and through Zeke, but if Yah Yeshua wanted them to know that they were speaking to his prophet, that might go a long way in their acceptance of Zeke's words in 17 through 21. When Yah Yeshua told him that he was making Zeke a watchman over the house of Yisrael, he was saying that he, that is Yehezkel, would be fully accountable if he didn't give them the full Monty of warning from Yah and they fell astray. But if he gave them the full Monty, they would be responsible individually for their own sins and would receive the just recompense of it or them. So, verse 18 is Yah's point here to Yehezkel. If I tell the wicked, in other words, dying, they will die for their evil, but I will hold you responsible as well. But if you do warn them, in verse 19, that they will suffer and they will not return from their wickedness, they shall die in their iniquity, but you will have delivered your own soul. And then, in verses 20 and 21, Yah reiterates what he said twice already, just to make sure that Zeke gets it. Maybe this is the origin of three's a charm. Here's Azamra on verse 20. And when a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, I will lay a stumbling block before him and he will die. That's verse 20. If the righteous man makes the mistake of thinking that on account of his having been righteous for a long time, God will forgive him for evil he now commits, I will prepare a stumbling block for him. That's according to Metsudas David. Now, the stumbling block will be that he will succeed in all his affairs in this world because he will eat in this world the fruits of the righteousness that he was intended to eat in the world to come, and his righteousness that he did will not be remembered. In other words, in the world to come, according to Radak. If he stops doing his righteousness, but he keeps eating the produce of his righteousness, That's as far as he's going to eat the produce of his righteousness. When he stops being righteous, he will be turned away. So, to recap, Yah is going to personally warn the Yehudi. Then he will send the prophet to reiterate the warning. If the Yehudi turn from his sins, he will save his soul. But if he doesn't, he will die in his sin, but the prophet will not suffer any consequence. But if Yah warns the Yehudi and the prophet doesn't reiterate the warning, and the Yehudi sins, the Yehudi will suffer the just compensation of his action, but Yah will require the Yehudi's life from Yechezkel. So Yechezkel becomes the second witness to the transgression of the Yehudi. This is Torah. In Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 7, it says this, and I'll finish with this. If there be found among you within any of thy gates, which Yah Elohecha giveth thee, man or woman that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of Yah Elohecha in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods, and worshipped them, either the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard, and inquired diligently, and behold, it is true. The thing is certain, and such abomination is wrought in Israel. Then shalt thou bring forth that man or that woman which hath committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, that man or that woman, and shalt stone them with stones till they die. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. At the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. I mean, after all, some guy might just have it out for him. Anyway, verse 7. The hands of the right witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of all the people. So thou shalt put the evil away from among you. Okay? That's what Yah is telling Yechezkel that he has to make sure happens. And it comes from Torah, not just from the prophets. Visions or whatever. This comes directly from Torah, and Yechezkel is a really, really righteous priest. He knows what he's doing. And by the way, I really think that Yechezkel, we'll see it a little bit later, is the father of Yirmiyahu. Okay? We'll talk about that when we get there. That's at the end of the chapter. That's what I got through verse 21.
Go ahead, Ken.
Okay, I'm just going to come from a slightly different angle.
That's what we're here for.
That's right. And we see in these verses, 16 to 21, I'm going to group all this together here, that the completion of this seven-day period readies Ezekiel in his new duty of being a watchman of Yah's people. He's now able to witness to their works and judge to whom he requires warning, which Yah calls the wicked. Ezekiel is now Yah's instrument of awakening to provide a chance for those in sin to be shown the truth and thus have the chance to turn away from their sin. It seems a tall order considering those in such sin, whom Ezekiel may not forewarn, would die in their sin at Ezekiel's hand. This reminds me of how a husband has the right to turn away or negate a wife's vow in the earth, and thus she is forgiven in Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 30. Now, though not the exact same determinations here, I like to see how one can reach out to save another's life as he is, and how it should be for us in love. Thus, this is Yah reaching out to those he now calls wicked, and I believe that he hopes that they will hear this warning and turn from their sin. He does love all of us that much. And note in verse 20 that he does continue to lay before those that he loves as well stumbling blocks. Now, we know these are not to be too much to handle, but nevertheless, they are given to help us grow. Now, we know that if such wicked are truly wicked, they will surely stumble and fall before the stumbling block. But we see that even though the righteous and even the wicked may fall to such a stumbling block, Yah desires to provide warning before a final judgment is proclaimed.
Amen.
So to me, you know, to me, this is Yah reaching out to those in sin, even unto the last minute or even the deepest of sin, to give all that he loves a chance to choose.
Amen.
Correctly. And thus, this is Ezekiel's duty in delivering souls. It's a tall order, but consider the amount of trust that Yah is putting in just this one man. I mean, Ezekiel is truly a spiritual kind of guy here. Probably, like I said earlier, possibly more than any other of the prophets. At least the way I'm seeing these words. And that's what I had to verse 21.
Amen.
So
and it's really interesting, isn't it? If what I said earlier is true, that Yehezkel is actually the father of Yirmiyahu, and how that just passed on from father to son, wouldn't that be cool? I have no proof of that. I just think that that's the case.
Okay. That's sounds like a long shot, but hey, go for it. I'll have to look that up myself a little bit.
All right, are we ready to continue?
You want verses 22 to 27 there, Mark?
Then the hand of Yahuwah was upon me there, and he said to me, arise, go out into the plain, and there I shall talk with you. So I arose, and I went out into the plain, and behold, the glory of Yahuwah stood there, like the glory which I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell on my face. Then the Ruach, the Spirit, entered me and set me on my feet and spoke with me and said to me, go, shut yourself inside your house. And you, O son of man, surely they will put ropes on you and you with them and bind you with them so that you cannot go out among them. And I will make your tongue cling to the roof of your mouth so that you shall be mute and not be one to rebuke them, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with you, I will open your mouth, and you shall say to them, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, he who hears, let him hear, and he who refuses, let him refuse, for they are a rebellious house. And we'll pause there, and let me just note, that's not the first time we've heard this rebellious house.
Oh, no, it's not. It won't be the last. Okay. And so, in verses 22 through 27, Yah tells Zeke to go out into the plain outside of Tel Aviv, that is Babylon, so he can talk to him. So Zeke got up, and he went where he was told to get the message from Yah. When he arrived, it was Yah Tzevaot who met him, and he fell on his face at his feet to worship him. Then Ruach HaKodesh, verse 24, indwelt him, set him on his feet, and told Zeke, go to your house and lock the doors. Azamra has a good comment on verse 22. They say this, and he said to me, arise, go out to the plain Bekah, in verse 22. He instructed me to go out to the plain where he showed me the glory as he had shown him by the river Kivar, for the plain was a place of great purity, greater purity than Tel Aviv, which was a human habitation. That's speculation, eisegesis, but I believe inspired speculation. That's me talking about this particular thing. Now, he sent him, Yah sent him this vision time after time in order to deepen his understanding of God's providence and his way of governing the creation. Moreover, that plain, Bekah, was the same plain in which the original Tower of Babylon had been built, according to Genesis 11:2. I don't know about that, but I'll go with it. And he began showing him his providence over his creatures when he mixed up their language and thwarted their intention. That's according to Radak on verse 22. So, the Hebrew word Bekah, translated plain in verse 23, is from the Hebrew 1234, believe it or not, HR 1234, to split or to open a crevice, and is described as a valley between two mountains, like Ebal and Gerizim. I hate robocalls. Anyway, let's see. I lost my place. Here we go. Glory he had showed him by the river Kabar, for the plain was a place of greater purity than Tel Aviv, which was a human habitation. That's speculation, eisegesis. Okay, I read that. He sent him this vision time after time in order to deepen his understanding of God's providence and his way of governing the creation. Moreover, the plain, Bika, was the same plain in which the original Tower of Babel had been built, and he began showing him his providence over his creatures when he mixed up their language and thwarted their intention. That's Radak on verse 22. The Hebrew word Bika, translated plain in verse 23, is from the Hebrew 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm sorry, I read all this already. To split open crevice, and is divided, described as a valley between two mountains like a Baal and Gerizim, the mountains of cursing and blessing at Shechem, like that. I think this is very like the area of Shechem, but is not. We are, after all, in the captivity in Babylon, not the hills north of Bethel, nor in Lebanon, where the present-day Bekaa Valley is. All of the valleys spoken of would put those who know them in mind of their familiar places if they saw them. When you are in a hill or mountain country, you'll understand, Flatlander. Here's a Zamra again. In the plain, God gave Yehezkel further instructions and a series of prophecies that are contained in the coming chapters, chapters 4 through 7. From now on, the prophet was to shut himself up in his house as if imprisoned, and not to speak to the people except when God opened his mouth in prophecy, for the people would not listen to him. The reason was, in the words of the repeated refrain in chapter 2, verse 5, 6, and 7, and chapter 3, verses 26 and 27, for they are a rebellious house. Now, in verses 24 through 27, Yah's spirit came on Yehezkel, set him on his feet, and said, you'd better get in the house, because these guys that I'm sending you to prophesy to are not going to like what I say through you. They will really want to kill you. Trust me, I'm there watching them even as I speak to you now. Okay, I embellished it a bit, but it's true. Yah was, is, and will always be there and then as he is here and now. He knows everything because he is there and here, always. That's from Mark and But that's what I believe. Yah is everywhere and everywhen, all right now. And also 6,000 years ago. Now, they were incapable of harming me, he says, Yah says. But you, being my mouthpiece to them, are going to be threatened by them constantly. You will be mistreated because you prove to them that they can also be in my presence regardless the physical circumstances they're in. It may actually be jealousy, that they're jealous of him. That's a possibility. That's me talking now. Now, in verse 26, it makes it sound like Yah will make Zeke physically unable to speak. I don't know about Zeke, but I know that would be best if he were sending me, because I would be in their faces about the mistreatment that they would give me. The word translated dumb is HR 481, alam, which means to bind or to tie together. I think that Zeke could not open his mouth to speak. Maybe he could open it to eat, or maybe not. But when Yah needed him to pass a message from Yah to the people, his mouth would work just fine. It would be almost as maddening to Yehezkel as to the people that he was prophesying to. The people would know what Yah wanted them to know.
Time's up there, under the moon. Well, what we know now is that it's time to break, so we'll pick up when we get back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for. I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. One day, one way, one way.
things I learned under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true. All right, we are back, folks. This is the second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. We're going to finish chapter 3, at least, in this one, and head into chapter 4 next. But before that, we interrupted MP at the top of the hour. He says he'd have made it, except for having, well, I guess had a Biden moment or something of that ilk. Lost his place. In any case, we'll go back and let him finish. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I had a Biden moment because my phone went off while I was talking. I picked the thing up, and it's a robocall, and I shut it off, and then I couldn't find my place in my notes again. Anyway, here we go. Back to it'll only take a minute. I think that Zeke could not open his mouth to speak. Maybe he could open it to eat, or maybe not. But when Zeke needed him to pass a message... I'm sorry, when Yah needed him to pass a message from Yah to the people, his mouth would work just fine. It would be almost as maddening to Yehezkel as to the people that he was prophesying to. The people would know what Yah wanted them to know because he would open Yehezkel's mouth to speak exactly what he allowed or commanded. Those who did what Yah told them through Zeke would prosper. Those who didn't, wouldn't. But that would be their own fault. If they were smart enough to see the difference was obedience, they might save their own worthless hides. I guess we'll see in chapters 4 through 7, which are coming up next. Ready for you, Ken.
All righty then. Let's see. Verses 22 and 23, this is where Yah tells him to rise, and he arises, and he ends up standing there before the glory of Yah. It seems that each time Ezekiel receives Yah's hand, something powerful occurs. It's very similar to the wind or spirit being brought forth. In this case, Yah raises him up and leads him to another place and readies him to speak. And I'm sure it was amazing and completely awesome that once Ezekiel arose and went as Yah instructed, that he was greeted with Yah's glory before him. I mean, it's no wonder he fell on his face. As if being touched by his hand and filled with his spirit wasn't enough. Gee, give me a little bit of any one of those. I don't care. He's now given the unforgettable vision that I'm sure he will remember the rest of his days. Yah has most assuredly prepared Ezekiel for the worst, with filling his senses and providing unforgettable memories that will keep him standing through thick and thin. Well, it's kind of funny in terms of standing. Verses 24 and 25, I sometimes giggle inside when I read that Ezekiel is filled with Yah's spirit to set him upon his feet. I'm guessing that the awe that has been instilled in him has left him with noodle legs that will not harden. So I can only imagine just how unworthy he may feel in the presence of such perfection and awesomeness. In any case, he's told to shut himself up in his own house. This may be very much like what I detailed in verse 15, in which Ezekiel may now be shut up in his house for a time to mentally prepare and consider what is about to happen and what his duty will be. And possibly to give him strength. in the last two verses, these last two verses of the chapter give me the impression that Yah desires Ezekiel to be his mouthpiece only, to speak his, well, let me just say to, for Ezekiel to speak his own word, especially while witnessing the sin and iniquities that were transpiring around him, could only lead to reproof or judgment, as Yah mentions. And since this is such a rebellious house, I believe Yah desires direct instruction only from him and him alone, meaning from Yah alone, not from Ezekiel. And thus Yah will put his words in Ezekiel's mouth, and this is what Yisrael will hear in their ears, if Amen. They have ears to hear. They will only hear the words of Yah and not any of the words of Ezekiel. And I can only assume from the way it's written that this is the will of Yah, that they only hear the words from Yah and not any judgment, because you know that if Ezekiel opens his mouth, most likely he is going to be probably a bit bitter and will be speaking judgment upon them. So I believe Yah just wants them to hear his words only. And that's through the end of the chapter 3. And that's all that I have. MC?
Are we ready to move on into chapter 4? And this one's going to be an interesting Absolutely. Vision and quite a bit of sure. numbering and a little bit more about the two houses as well. So this is going to be a fun place to go. You also, says chapter 4, verse 1, son of man, take a clay tablet and lay it before you and portray on it a city, Jerusalem. Lay siege against it, build a siege wall against it, and heap up a mound against it. Set caps against it also, and place battering rams against it all around. So basically what he's going to do is kind of a military simulation here of what's very likely to happen to Jerusalem. Moreover, take for yourself an iron plate and set it as an iron wall between you and the city. Set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you shall lay siege against it. This will be a sign to the house of Israel. And let's pause there. Let me go to Ken first this time. We'll get to the specifics of the rest of the vision here in just a second, or the instruction, actually. Go ahead, Ken.
Ezekiel is told to take a brick and engrave the name Yerushalayim upon it. Then note all that Yah wants Ezekiel to set up against it. I mean, there's a lot here. Quite a lot of heavy forces, for sure. And this brick, this is not hardened stone that these forces are to come against. No, it is a man-made brick, much softer than stone. Might this be why Yah has his holy city name written, of Yerushalayim written upon it? This is to possibly show how weak his people truly are, and to show how they have not built up Yah in his house in their midst. Instead, we have a man-made substance that does not hold up to much of anything. Recall that Yah had his commandments written on stone, and this is truly significant. Especially when we consider how a stone is made. You know, nature itself molds it.
That's right.
Which is, this is of Yah's characteristics. This is, you know, figurative of Yah himself, how he molds us. You know, we're not to be molded by man-made ways or man's ways. We're to be molded by Yah's ways. But a brick is something completely man-made, and thus prone and destined for destruction. And such things are a sign for Yisrael. And yet, they don't seem to know the signs, do they?
Right.
They've been shown signs for hundreds of years. And it's as if they are just blinded. It's amazing. I mean, especially after going through the entire scroll of Yirmiyahu. I mean, that whole scroll just blows me away.
Probably they've ignored it for so long that they just can't see the truth anymore.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, I think this is why Yah is showing or having Ezekiel characterize them as a brick. And that's what I had through verse 3.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Another Jethro Tull song, don't you? Thick as a brick. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. There you go. So I'm passing the torch to you guys.
Okay, let me cover 1 through 3 here. Here's Azamra's opening to this chapter. They say, at various junctures, certain prophets were instructed to carry out symbolic actions as a way of vividly dramatizing their message. In the present chapter, Ezekiel, still in the plain, receiving the series of prophecies that began in verse 23 of the previous chapter, is given three sets of instructions. I think that and this is me now, I think that the tile spoken of is actually a block, as TSK has this on a Hebrew word translated as tile in the KJV. A tile that is lavena, the Hebrew 38:43, generally denotes a brick, and Palladius informs us that the bricks in common use among the ancients were 2 feet long, 1 foot broad, and 4 inches thick. And on such a surface, the whole siege might be easily portrayed. Perhaps, however, it may here denote a flat tile, like a Roman brick, which were commonly used for tablets, as we learned from Pliny in History Naturalis, I'm thinking, 1, chapter 7, and page 57. So anyway, now that Palladius was obviously a Roman who was familiar with Pliny the Elder, whose Natural History is the oldest known complete set of books dating to the 1st century CE. Palladius is quoted here. Pliny died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE. From that quote, you can see that the bricks spoken of in Yehezkel were roughly 24 by 12 by 4, while the Roman brick that the KJV translators probably had in mind were probably smaller in all dimensions, since they were being used as tablets, not paving stones. But here's Azamra's comment on verses 1 to 3. The brick. Ezekiel was to take a large building block and carve on it a representation of the city of Jerusalem, which he was to surround with siege towers, siege mounds, army camps, battering rams, symbolizing the coming Babylonian assault. And take for yourself, there's a quote now, and take for yourself an iron pan and set it as a wall of iron between you and the city, in verse 3. From the day the Holy Temple was destroyed, a wall of iron stands between Israel and their Father in heaven, as it says, take for yourself an iron pan, in Berachot chapter 30, or 32b. Now, that's from Azamra now. Now, Yah told Yehezkel, in verse 2, to portray on the stone a replica of Jerusalem, whether by paint or by small replicas of chariots and etc., we aren't told, but Yehezkel knew, and to lay siege to it, was to build a siege mound against it and set up rams of a battering type, not a goat, against its gates. The word used here for ram is H3733, car, believe it or not. That's a Chaf Resh from the Hebrew 3769, Harar, which means to round or a battering ram. Rams were generally made of thick tree trunks or perhaps of brass on a siege work built for the purpose. Yehezkel was to make the replica of Jerusalem as close to reality as possible, I think, including all the gates of the city and the siege works against all of them. That's how I would picture it anyway. Why allow the inhabitants a means of escape, right? So in verse 3, Yah told Zeke to get an iron pan and use it to portray the wall of iron between himself and the replica city and set himself against the city on a brick. I could be wrong, but I think that Yah told Zeke that he should lay siege to the city on the brick and let the elders of the city know that he was representing Yah, who was going to bring the coming siege against them in Yerushalayim. Oh, look, that's just what Yah says at the end of verse 3. This is a sign to Yisrael. Yisrael is the whole house of Yaakov, not just Yehuda and Yerushalayim. And Israel had been carried off to Assyria about 200 or so years before. I think that the prophecy we're getting here may be to Chol Yisrael, not just Yehuda. And it may yet be for Yisrael in our future. Look at the state of the world today. We may be on the very brink of another world war, and this one will very likely go nuclear. I hope that America finds a competent CNC before stuff like that hits the fan. I'm open to questions and comments on 1 to 3. That's through verse 3.
Okay.
I could go further.
Ken, are you ready?
Oh.
I have no more questions or comments. Verse 3.
I'm sorry, I just looked at my notes again, and I do have a little bit more on that 1 through 3. So let me hit that.
Go for it.
Okay, so let me begin this section with a quote from my book on Genesis, from chapter 37. Joseph's a coat of many colors was a woolen coat of different colored strips of wool woven together. And this will tie in. Take my word for it. It represented not only the birthright, but also the many nations that would be represented by him in the Olam Haba, the world to come, as Ephraim's seed spread throughout the earth due to its long exile. Now, the intended length of the exile is given in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 3c through 6, where it says, "This shall be a sign to the house of Israel, lie thou upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity." Verse 5, "For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days, so shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Yisrael. And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Yehuda 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year." Okay, that's the end of the quote from the scripture. But Ephraim didn't hearken to Yah, so he had to remind us of what the consequences are for the failure to heed. In Leviticus 26, he says, in verses 13 to 18, "I am Yah Eloheinu, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondmen, and I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you go upright. But if ye will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, and if you shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhor my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that ye break my covenant, I also will do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, and burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth. And if you will not yet for all of this hearken unto me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sin." Now, that's really tough stuff. Now, 390 years after the Assyrian exile, Ephraim did not return to Yah's commands, and we have been in exile now since 721 BCE. 390 years times 7 equals 2,730 years. 2,730 minus 721 equals 2009, plus 1 for the non-existent year 0. In other words, 2010. Folks, we are in the right time frame for the end of Ephraim's exile. The year of the beginning of this reckoning could be off by a few years, but the question is, has Ephraim returned to Yah's paths yet? A very small remnant has. But will that be enough? If not, how much longer do we need to wait? Leviticus 26 again, verses 19 to 21. "And I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. And your strength shall be spent in vain, and your land shall not yield her increase. Neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. And if you walk contrary unto me, I will not hearken unto me, and will not hearken unto me, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins. Boy, do I hope I'm wrong. Man, do I hope and pray that Yah works a miracle in the world and brings a bunch of people out of the Constantinian religion and back to Torah. We need to always be open to Yah's leading to call people out of their Constantinian dispensationalism. They may be in the Book of Life, but when will we see the deliverance of the land and its people? We will certainly see soon. That's the end of my quote from Genesis, Moshe 1. So anyway, that's big, important stuff, and it really does tie in to this particular passage that we've read today. If we don't wake up, if we don't get the people of the world to wake up, we get seven times more that's going to come at us. 15,000 more years? Thank you. I'm not ready for that. Anyway, go ahead. That's what I got through verse 3.
That seemed like that was through verse 6. Didn't you read verses 4 through 6?
I have.
And talk about them?
I will get to that, too. Go.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay.
I was going to say that he went well beyond anything we talked about but or read, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll just comment on 4 through 6, and since Mark read them for us. I believe.
Oh, that's right. I did, didn't I? I'm sorry.
Yes, you did. I believe the number of days that Ezekiel is laying on each side was for, like Mark said, all of Israel to be shown and to realize just how long they were to be kept in bondage. They could also count back from the start of captivity to see when their wickedness truly began. So maybe that's kind of a, you know, learning lesson as well. So all of this is so quite revealing to all of them. And we should, I think, immediately associate the left and right with the times when Yah speaks of not walking in his ways, when not walking straight, but to the left and to the right. And thus Yah is associating such directions with the sin of his people. You know, so of course you have one of the tribes, or of the houses, which by the way, this is yet more, proof, I believe, in some of those who try to teach the, what some call the two house theology. There truly are two houses. And we can see that here, that, you know, one house is being captive for so long, and the other house is being captive for a different amount of time, and each is for their own sins, as we see it. The iniquity, even though it's kind of funny, what we read about in chapter 5, it is that Yah just is really upset with the southern house. We're going to see that, and I guess I won't get into that right now. But anyway, let me just stop with that, because I think we're about at a break here, and I really don't have much more through verse 6.
Yeah, we're within 40 seconds of a break, so we could read on from 4 through 6.
Okay, as if we hadn't already talked about him a bit, but okay. So let's just summarize it. I got about 30 seconds. He's going to be told to lie on both sides.
Okay.
And we're going to get some numbers that are going to correspond to years here. Mark has an opinion. He's kind of already let slip on this. But he says, lie also on your left side. Lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. So again, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. Here we're talking northern kingdom. According to the number of the days that you lie on it, you shall bear their iniquity. For I've laid on you the years of their iniquity. And we'll pick it up there after we get back.
I'm breathing, and I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more wars, and I'll
Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come on, come on, dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come on, come on, dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. Let's set a line down by the Lord. The 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new. Challenge it in motion.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the last segment of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, and we have a little bit more, well, a lot more. We're going to finish Chapter 4 today, I don't think. But let's see. I was reading, only because we were almost out of time. Ken, do we go back to you and let you pick it up where you'd want to continue?
No, I had finished, I think, through verse 6, and... MP had some more stuff on
four through six
on that. Yeah.
So here we go.
Go right ahead, MP.
In verse 4, Yah tells Yechezkel to lie on his left side, which would portray the time of the iniquity in the house of Israel. Yah is here empowering Yechezkel to lie nearly stationary for more than a full year, 390 days, on his left side, and bear their iniquity for the 390 years that they had been unfaithful to Yah. Was Yah laying the iniquity of Israel and Samaria on Yechezkel? That is exactly what he says in verse 5. Does this speak of the long-suffering of Yeshua in his taking our just recompense on of his innocent, sinless self? You betcha it does. Azamra has a long comment on verses 4 through 8. That's why this is going to take a while. Lying on his side, verses 4 through 8. The brick would be positioned where the prophet would gaze upon it and gaze upon it before him, in verse 7, while lying immobilized on one side for extended periods. Lying on one side for a long time without being able to turn onto the other side is extremely hard. Radak says that on verse 4. Now Rashi explains that Ezekiel was to endure this pain and suffering for a specific number of days corresponding to the number of years that Israel had vexed Elohim with their defiance. And you will atone for their sins, since the punishment I have said I will bring upon them are harsh in your eyes. I have made it easier for you to bear the pain that I have suffered for the total number of years that they have sinned before me, by turning them into the corresponding number of days, that according to Rashi on verses 4 and 5. Now, through this pain, the sins of Israel would be atoned without their being utterly destroyed on account of their sins. That's according to Metzudas David on verse 4. When a king of flesh and blood wants to punish a rebellious province, if he is cruel, he kills them all. If he is kind, he kills half of them. But if he is overflowing with kindness, he chastises their leaders. Similarly, the Holy One, blessed be he, chastised Ezekiel in order to cleanse Israel of their sins. That according to the Sanhedrin 39a. Now, still on Azamra. The prophet was to lie on his left side to atone for the sins of the house of Israel, the 10 tribes, whose kingdom was centered to the left, that is to the north of Judah. See Ezekiel 16:46, Metzudas David on verse 4. Here's that short comment from Azamra, which we'll see in a month or so in depth. Okay? And I'm going to break for just a second. The mother of the land of Canaan, which loathed her husband and her children, in the sense of vomiting out the sinful Canaanese nations. Jerusalem's sister, they are Shamron, the citadel of the 10 tribes, who had also been vomited out and exiled from the land, and Sodom, which had been overturned because of her wickedness in verse 46. The sins of Jerusalem were far more serious than those of Sodom and the 10 tribes in verses 47 to 51. And what was worse, than anything was that Jerusalem used to sanctimoniously judge and condemn the 10 tribes for their sins when she herself was no better. Now here's a Mark Petrone edit, and we'll go back to Azamra in a minute. Here's Ezekiel 16, verses 45 and 47, that Azamra has just alluded to. Verse 45 says, "Thou art thy daughter, thy mother's daughter, that loatheth her husband and her children. Thou art the sister of thy sisters, which loathe their husbands and their children. Your mother was a Hittite, and your father was an Amorite." That's weird. Anyway, "and thine elder sister is Samaria, she and her daughters that dwell in the at thy left hand, and thy younger sister that dwelleth at thy right hand is Sodom and her daughters. Yet hast thou not walked after their ways, nor done after their abominations, but as if that were a very little thing, thou hast corrupted more than they in all thy ways." Jerusalem had not gone overtly away from Yah, having all the pomp and circumstance of the temple of Yah, but had actually done worse, as we'll see in a minute. Back to Azamra now. Rashi on verse 5 gives an exact amount of how all the years in which Israel sinned from the period of the first judges until the exile of the 10 tribes by Sennacherib add up to a total of 390. Likewise, in this comment on verse 6, Rashi gives us an account of the 40 years in which Judah sinned from the time of the exile of the 10 tribes until the year of Ezekiel's present prophecy, 5 years after the exile of King Jehoiakim, in the fifth year of King Zedekiah. "Behold, I will lay cords upon you," in verse 8. "You shall feel the stringency of my decree of instructions as if you were bound by thick ropes, so that you are incapable of turning from side to side." That, according to Rashi, Ad Lok again. The Treasury of Scripture Knowledge has this on verse 5. "The number of years," that's 3, "will take us back from the year in which Judea was finally desolated by Nebuzaradan, BCE 584, to the establishment of idolatry in Israel by Jeroboam, BC 975, plus or minus 390 years, beginning from 1 Kings 12:33, and ending in Jeremiah 52:30. So he, that is Jeroboam, offered upon the altar which he had made at Bethel, the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised of his own heart, and ordained a feast unto the children of Israel, and he offered upon the altar and burnt incense." That's in 1 Kings 12:33. Then in Jeremiah 52:39 he says this, "For he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel, the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart, and ordained the feast unto the children of Israel, and he offered upon the altar and burnt incense." This is the king of Israel offering these offerings in Samaria. Okay? Now, Yah had ordained no such things or days as set apart unto him. These were figments of Jeroboam's imagination. And now, Yechezkel gets to lie on his left side for 390 days to illustrate the judgment on Jeroboam's Israel, and as Yah himself says, bear the iniquity of the house of Yehuda, even as Yah himself would bear the iniquity of the world on that tree in roughly 600 years. Then in verse 6, and I think, I'll finish here. Then in verse 6, Yah gave enough muscle control to Zeke that he could reposition himself, I think changing his orientation foot to head and vice versa, on his right side, and look at the same block for 40 days to bear Yehuda's iniquity for its 40 years of idolatry, as is illustrated in chapter 8 and verse 16, which says this, "And he brought me into the inner court of Yah's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of Yah, between the porch and the altar, about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of Yah, and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. These were the entire priesthood of Israel, including the high priest, kneeling and bowing to the sun as it rose in the east, and rubbing their anal sphincters in Yah's face. Jeroboam's Israel's sin was bad enough, but this was the entire priesthood, who had been trained painstakingly in their duties to Yah and had done them to the letter, daily in the very presence of Yah, but actually worshipped the sun as it rose over the Mount of Olives. Here's what TSK has to say about this verse. This represented the 40 years during which gross idolatry prevailed in Judah from the Reformation of Josiah in B.C. 624 and the same final desolation of the land. In my mind and in all of this, Yechezkel typifies Mashiach Yeshua's redemption of Chol Yisrael, not just Yehuda, Chol Yisrael. And I'm open to questions and comments through verse 6. I don't know if we read that far, but... That's what I got.
Very good, Mark. Very good.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ken, should we read on or you want to add anything?
No, I'm good. If we can just read on a couple okay. verses past 6.
We got cut right at the break about here. So basically, he's going to lay on one side according to the number of days, 390 days. And you'll bear on this side the iniquity of the northern kingdom, the house of Israel. And when you've completed them, you lie again on your right side, then you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah. Now that would be the southern kingdom, 40 days. I have laid on you a day for each year. Therefore you shall set your face toward the siege of Jerusalem, your arm uncovered, and you shall prophesy against it. And surely I will restrain you so that you cannot turn from one side to another till you have ended the days of your siege. So this is one of those things when I read it, I think, wow, this is a really long time for the prophet to lay there. Maybe it was just a really yes. intense long-term vision. But regardless, this is quite a lengthy demonstration, I guess you'd say, of the nastiness here. So I'm going to redeem you, and you won't be able to turn until the days of your siege have ended. Also, take for yourself the following: wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. Put them in one vessel, and make bread of them for yourself. During the number of days that you lie on your side, that would be 390 days, you shall eat it. Your food which you eat shall be by weight, 20 shekels a day. From time to time you shall eat it. You'll also drink water by measure, 1/6 of a hand. From time to time you shall drink. And you shall eat it as barley cakes and bake it using fuel of human waste in their sight. So this is pretty gnarly stuff. Then Yahuwah said, so shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread among the Gentiles, the nations, the goyim is actually the word there, where I will drive them. And let's pause, and then we'll talk about what he says here in a second. MP, should we go to you first this time?
Can if you wish.
Okay.
Beginning at verse 7. Okay. Remember that Zeke is lying on his right side now, facing the block with the representation of Yerushalayim on it. He has just rolled over, as it were, from lying for 390 days on his left side as an illustration of Yah's judgment against Samaria Israel over their years of apostasy and Molech Hasatan worship. Now Yehuda gets the same treatment. But I think the judgment of Yehuda, though shorter, is much more intense because of the revelatory differences there had to have been in the divided nation's worship of Yah. Yehuda, with both the temple and the priesthood overseeing the worship, was much more accountable and therefore much more worthy of punishment. Where it says, thine arm uncovered, I think it's talking of his left arm, since his right is on the deck. TSK says, refers to Isaiah 52:10 on and thine. Here's what it says in Isaiah 52:10. Yah hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of Eloheinu. Have I said yet that I think Yechezkel is typical of Mashiach Yeshua? I think I did.
Yes.
And do you think, like I do, that the holy arm of Yah is Yeshua, and by extension here, Yechezkel's free arm? I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. Verse 8. Still Yah speaking to Yechezkel and Yehuda Yerushalayim, he says that he will bind him in this place. Now, there are no physical bonds on him, but Yah has only left one arm able to move. his left arm. Now, the right arm is the more prevalent go-to arm among humans. So Yah's using Zeke's left arm to deliver his judgment to Yehuda alludes to his favor for Yehuda in the probable severity of his judgment. Okay, he's using the non-dominant arm. Dominant arm is what I'm thinking. Now, it will not be as severe because Yehuda had been less unfaithful to him than had Ephraim Yehuda until recently. The last 40 years or so, Israel Samaria had been, to this point, judged and exiled for almost 390 years. By comparison, Yehuda's exile had only just begun. Now, in verse 9, Yah gives the recipe for the food that Yehezkel will be eating for the next 40 days. Did he not eat very well or at all for the 390 days on his left side? He probably did eat well, but this recipe is given here for a reason. Don't ask me what it is. I just know that Yah doesn't do things for no reason. Okay? Now, is the recipe the same as Ezekiel 4:9 bread? That's an interesting idea that you can get at most healthy food stores. Maybe not in quantities used, but probably in the types of beans and grains used in the recipe. It's pretty tasty and healthy, by the way. Easy on the digestive system. Ezekiel 4:9 bread, if you can find it. Now, you're going to pay $6 a loaf for it, but it's really, really good bread. Back to the passage now. Here's Azamra on chapter 4 and verses 9 through 17. And take for yourself wheat and barley, etc., in verse 9. During these extended periods of lying on one side, Ezekiel was to eat in the same way as people facing famine under siege. Barley is normally animal feed. People only make bread of wheat mixed with inferior grains when supplies are scarce, and they then permit themselves only minimal rations for fear of being left with nothing. That's in verses 9 through 11. The most repulsive aspect of the prophet's diet was that the fuel for baking his crude loaves would be dried human excrement in verse 12. This would symbolize how the people of Israel will eat their bread unclean among the nations to which I shall drive them in verse 13. This decree so appalled Ezekiel, a priest who had eaten only kosher, literally pure food from his youth, that he cried out bitterly in horror. I have never eaten an animal that died of itself or was torn by beasts, not even a dying animal that was slaughtered hurriedly to permit it consumption. Nor did loathsome meat ever enter my mouth, not even from an animal over which a sage had to issue a ruling because of a question over its fitness for consumption, not even an animal from which the priestly portions had not been truly separated. That in the Talmud, Chulin 37b. Because of Ezekiel's plea for mercy, God softened the decree, permitting him to use animal droppings as fuel to bake his bread instead of human excrement. Even so, it was impossible to avert the coming famine in Jerusalem, in which the people would waste away because of their sins. May Hashem turn our hearts to him and bring us to complete teshuvah. And that's what I got. And I went pretty much through the rest of the chapter. Not quite all the way. But go ahead, Ken. Give us what you got.
Okay. Let's see. 7 and 8, when his arm is uncovered. I believe this uncovering of the arm is to indicate nakedness and shame. Remember that he is representing Yisrael in all of this. And he is bound, symbolizing that Yah's will be done.
Amen.
And Yisrael will have no might of its own and will surely fall to their enemies and go into captivity. And to start with the face towards the siege is to ensure and indicate to Yisrael that they will see and they will feel the wrath of their enemies. At least that's what I'm seeing here in terms of, you know, what's brought to their eyes. And of course the idea of the arm being uncovered like there is no protection. Usually you might have a wing of protection or, you know, something like that. Here we have a uncovered arm, completely uncovered. Verses 9 to 13, Yah dictates this exact food and drink menu. Not one I would prefer. I really wouldn't want to visit that restaurant. To include exact portions for Ezekiel's continued existence. And to then ensure that food is mixed with the dung of man is a perfect example to indicate the misery and disgust that their future holds while under bondage. Yisrael will be treated terribly, and their lives will be full of stench. But this is what they will do to survive. They will take whatever their enemies give them. And Yah makes this clear in verse 13, that what they would be eating would be defiled, for they would most assuredly be strangers in a strange land. And thus is this punishment from Yah, that what they consume, you know, what they live on, will be disgusting. And he says that this is how it will be when you go into bondage. So it's a real deal. No doubt about it. It's definitely likened to that. And that's what I have through verse 13. So maybe we can have MC read a little bit more.
If you are set. So we've got the diet laid out, and he's laying on the side. You'll eat barley cakes and bake it using the fuel of humans. And this is what's going to happen. You're going to eat the defiled bread among the goyim, the nations where I'll drive them. So, he says, in response to all of this, Ah, Yahuwah Elohi. And it's, I don't know if it's Elohi or Eloheka, because I don't have the Hebrew here. Anyway, indeed, I have never defiled myself from my youth till now. I have never eaten what died of itself or was torn by horses. Again, this is going to be similar to what MP already read, but let's make sure we get it all out there. Or torn by beast, nor has abominable flesh ever come into my mouth. And then he said to me, see, I'm giving you cow dung instead of human waste. So, there you go, clean dung instead of human waste, and you shall prepare your bread over that. Moreover, he said to me, son of man, surely I will cut off the supply of bread in Jerusalem. They shall eat bread by weight and with anxiety and shall drink water by measure and with dread. Now, you know, as I'm reading this again, guys, I can't help but think, have you been following what's happening as the Biden regime turns the world over to World War III and provokes the communist Chinese? This sounds a lot like what we might be seeing come to pass in Taiwan. Absolutely. As Taiwan is being cut off. So they'll eat bread with anxiety. Absolutely. And there you go. There's a lot of anxiety as the Chinese are doing these tests, you know, military exercises. Is this a real one or is this a fake? How long am I going to be cut off? They don't know. So that they might lack bread and water and be dismayed with one another and waste away because of their Torahlessness. All right. Ken, let's go to you. We got about we got less than a minute. So just wrap things up with that.
I have a little bit to say on two different sections here. 14 of 15, I feel like what Ezekiel says to Yah is a plea to let Yah know that he has not polluted himself with forbidden meat, according to Yah's Torah. And taking it back to his youth is most certainly containing all the days in which he was able to choose and choose rightly. So Yah most certainly knew this to be true. And it appears that he rewards him with cow dung instead of human dung. I'm sure it would still hold some good stench, but at least it's from a clean animal and not from the most unclean, from those men walking in wickedness.
All right, and we are at the break. We'll pick it up. We'll finish chapter 4 next time. Thanks, guys.